country roads, take me home to the place I belong, West Virginia.
If you ain't first, you're last, and if you can't think of a different NASCAR movie to quote for your podcast intro, then you're still last. My name is Mike Smith, and this is Film Bookcast, the official podcast of filmbook.com. Joining me, as always, is a guy who said he retired 4 years ago, but still worked on just about everything before making his triumphant return.
Mike Tacrescio.
How are you doing today, Mike?
Good. It's real nice to be back in my podcasting chair.
Yes.
After my four-year retirement of podcasting.
We kind of did take a Soderbergh-esque retirement. Because it's been about like 4 weeks, 3 or 4 weeks since we last recorded a Film Bookcast.
That's true.
Which is comparable to the 4 years it's been since Soderbergh last directed a movie. So
There's
that.
And in that time, we also recorded a podcast.
That's true. So So it's just like Soderbergh's retirement.
Yeah. Because we're the same people.
Exactly. It's exactly the same. You don't have to look any further than that to see the similarities. If you've never listened to Film Bookcast before, first we start with some film news, and then we move on into some discussions where Mike and I each discuss whatever piece of media we've been consuming lately, and then after that, we will move on into our featured review this week. It is the newest film from director Steven Soderbergh and his big return after supposedly retiring 4 years ago, Logan Lucky. Now, Mike, are you a Soderbergh fan, a Soderbergian, so to speak?
Sure, we can pretend that's a thing.
Yeah.
I mean, I am a recent convert to Soderbergh's or convert. That's not the right word, but whatever.
You've recently entered the Church of the Soderbergh.
Yes. Yeah. Recently baptized. Contagion, Haywire, and Side Effects. His last three movies before retiring were some of my favorite movies of those years, and I think they were might have even been the same year. He puts movies out like all the time.
They were all like a year after each other. Yes, Contagion was 2011, Haywire was 2012, and Side Effects was 2013. But in that time, he also directed Magic Mike in 2012. He also did Behind the Candelabra in 2013. So yeah, he generally works on like a movie a year, or like he works a lot.
You know?
And we'll talk about Steven Soderbergh and all his stuff very soon. But right now, we got to get into film news.
Hi! It's time for...
What?
It's time for...
Who?
It's time for...
Film news.
Hi! It's time for...
What?
It's time for...
Who?
It's time for...
Film news. Film news.
All right, it's time to get into some film news on Film Bookcast here, and it has been a couple of weeks since we recorded our last episode of Film Bookcast, so there's been a lot of stuff to get through, Mike. I cut out a lot of stuff, but I still had quite a bit of stories that I really wanted to talk about, so I'm going to do a segment that we're going to call Quick News and just get a couple of things out of the way really fast. The first is that the Coen Brothers TV show, which we've talked about in the past, The Ballad of Buster Scruggs, will be a miniseries. It'll be 6 episodes, and it was recently announced. It's going to be on Netflix in 2018. It's a Netflix original, so pretty exciting about that. Pretty excited about that. I mean, Tim Blake Nelson is the star of that show, and I love him. I love his work. He was, of course, in the Coen Brothers movie Over the Where Art Thou. He played Delmar. He was Mr. Pedansky in Holes and a whole bunch of great stuff. I love Tim Blake Nelson. And that's pretty cool. The press release for this thing was also fantastic, if you saw that, because the press release, like, you know, it's Netflix announcing the show, and then when reached for comment, the Coens had one thing to say, and they said, "We are streaming motherfuckers."
That's the most Coen Brothers thing ever.
I know. And yeah, it was pretty great. And what was great about it is that it just said, "We are streaming motherfuckers," without a comma. And so people were wondering, like, wait, did they mean... Did they forget the comma and meant, like, we are streaming and they're calling us the motherfuckers? Or are they the streaming motherfuckers? There's a huge debate about this on Twitter.
Wow.
And I firmly believe they intentionally left out that comma because they themselves are the streaming motherfuckers. But so wanted to bring that up, put that on people's radar. The Ballad of Buster Scruggs, probably going to be the best show of 2018. Throwing that out there.
Bold move.
Throwing that out there now. So I wanted to throw that out there. And then one last bit of quick news. Creed 2 looks like it's actually shaping up to happen. I don't know if there's any word yet on who's directing it. I know Ryan Coogler is deep in Black Panther right now, so it could be somebody else. But it looks like a familiar face to the Rocky franchise will be coming back for this one, Mike. And I got to say, I'm kind of excited about it. Dolph Lundgren, Ivan Drago himself. It looks like he's going to be returning to the Rocky franchise for Creed 2, and that is bonkers.
Yeah, what a crazy sentence.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I love Creed. I think Creed is one of the best movies of the past couple of years, and it was such a great next Rocky movie, and I don't even know if I need a Creed 2. But at the same
Well,
I was going to say, in my heart, I always knew they would make Creed 2, and
right.
even when I walked out of Creed, I was like, you know, my ideal sequel would be Adonis Creed fighting the son of Ivan Drago.
Yeah, yeah.
And now he might actually be fighting Ivan Drago. I don't know if that's – Dolph Lundgren's got to be like in his 60s, right? Like 50s or 60s.
I would think so.
And I got to say, I love Dolph Lundgren too. I don't know if I mentioned that yet, but I am a big fan of him in all his stuff. And he's kind of been quietly making a comeback in recent years. You know, he was in the Expendables movies, but, you know, he's popped up in other things since then. And also, he's going to be in Aquaman, I believe. He's going to be in James Wan's Aquaman. And he was one of the villains on this season of Arrow, season 5 of Arrow.
Wow.
And he was incredible. So, yeah, I am very much down for the Dolph Lundgrenaissance, and for that to culminate in Creed 2, I think will be a lot of fun. So,
I secretly hope that the Expendables, the failure of the Expendables franchise left is filled by the Creed franchise. It's just going to be all of the old action stars are now boxers, and they're going to join the Creed movies.
That would be ideal. I mean, I never watched the Expendables, but I would love those actors to just be in the Rocky movies and for those movies to be good.
Like, for no reason, just because.
Like in the next movie, Creed has to fight Jason Statham. Like I would be so in. I would be 110% into that. That would be pretty great. So I wanted to throw that out there, too. That's our quick news for the day. And then we can get a little more in-depth on some of this stuff. So, Mike, you and I are big fans of a little-known science fiction franchise called Star Wars.
Mm-hmm. Most listeners probably haven't heard of it.
It's a little bit on the obscure side. But Disney recently bought Star Wars. And they are in the process of making new Star Wars movies every year from now until the end of time.
Right.
And so they've already come out with Force Awakens, and they came out with a spinoff called Rogue One. Episode 8 is coming out this year. The Han Solo spinoff is coming out next year. And then after that, you got Episode 9. But what about 2020, Mike? We have to look to the future.
How long can we print money for is the question that Disney asks themselves.
Exactly. Well, it looks like 2020 will most likely be the release date for another Star Wars spinoff. That's always been the case. But now we finally have an idea of what that spinoff is going to be. It looks like it's a spinoff about Obi-Wan Kenobi. It's officially in the works. And I'm not surprised. That's been rumored for a little while.
Yeah.
But this time around, we know who's probably going to direct it. It's Stephen Daldry, who directed movies like Billy Elliot and Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close and The Reader. Not the guy I would have imagined for a Star Wars movie, but you know, after the events of after what happened with Phil Lord and Chris Miller, I can see Disney not wanting to go with the you know, people with a really distinct voice. And
yeah, you know, let's get the most middle of the road guy we can get.
Yeah, which honestly at this point, if they keep bringing on like Phil Lords and Chris Millers and then just like stamping down their voices, I would rather they just have like middle of the road directors to just do whatever Kathleen Kennedy wants them to do. Cause generally speaking, these movies do turn out pretty good. I want them to be at least pretty good with the possibility to be great. And I think that's what Rian Johnson's Episode 8 is going to be. I'm really holding out hope for that one. I think it's going to be really good. But
yeah.
So Stephen Daldry, fine, whatever. More to the point though, do you think Ewan McGregor will be back as Obi-Wan Kenobi in the Star Wars spinoff?
So I was thinking about it the other day, and here's my question just about, Obi-Wan's story. Are there big enough and interesting enough gaps in his story that we don't already have, like that we need this movie?
Well, I mean, we can assume, okay, so there's 20 years in between Revenge of the Sith and A New Hope. And I'm assuming that it would be somewhere in that time period where this movie takes place.
But doesn't he just hide in a cave for 20 years?
Well,
like,
I mean, that's what we assumed, but maybe he,
maybe not.
Maybe
I guess you're right.
An adventure with space pirates or something, you know, like whatever.
True.
There actually is in the Star Wars comics. I used to read the Marvel started printing out Star Wars comics around the time, like shortly after Disney bought Star Wars, because Disney owns Marvel. And so it's all a perpetual cash machine.
Yes.
And I read like the first like 10 or 15 issues of the main Star Wars comic, and like issue like 7 or 8 was like an Obi-Wan solo story. Detailing like an adventure he had while he was on Tatooine looking after Luke. So there could be something to that. where he's just it could be just some standalone adventure, has nothing to do with anything, just could be Obi-Wan doing his Obi-Wan thing, and like that would be fine. And Ewan McGregor would be perfect for that too. Like I would really love it. Like he's talked about the role before and talked about the possibility of coming back, and he says he'd be open to it. So I really hope that that's what's going to happen. So that could be really enticing. My thing though is that, you know, they have so much potential with these Star Wars spinoffs to do different things with this universe. And it seems like they keep coming back to like characters that we already know and like situations that we already know. Like Rogue One was all new characters, but it was a situation that we already like were familiar with, you know, with the Rebels and the Death Star plans. Like we already knew how that turned out, you know? Mm-hmm. And now we're getting a Han Solo movie, and now we're getting an Obi-Wan Kenobi movie. And it's like, man, I really just want like, you know, that Zack Snyder Star Wars Seven Samurai movie that was supposed to come out. not necessarily from Zack Snyder, but just like something like that, you know, like just like a random Star Wars adventure, you know, do KOTAR or something, Knights of the Old Republic, like, you know, do something insane, because you have you have limitless money to make these movies, and literally everyone in the world's going to see them, you know, like regardless of what you make. So
just pick something that's new, and we haven't. Well, I mean, Rogue One, I will count as original. Because it was a departure from the kind of style, you know, it was a Vietnam movie, basically, that happened to be about Star Wars. But, yeah, I'm a little excited, nervous about, I mean, but of an Obi-Wan movie, but we have no information about it yet, so I'm still...
Again, we're not seeing this until at least 2020, which is, for those of you counting, 3.5 years from now. Or 2.5 years from now, I should say. But
so that's a big ask in the current world climate. So we'll see what happens.
We could not be around for the Obi-Wan Kenobi movie, but we'll see. Anyway, so I wanted to talk about that. And then I have some pretty insane news, Mike. I feel like people aren't talking about this enough. You know, this came out a few weeks ago.
Is Shrek 5 finally announced? Is it happening, Mike?
Nope, not Shrek 5. Although, you know, I wait with bated breath, because once that release date gets announced, we are doing like a running tab on this podcast about about how many days left to go until Shrek 5 comes out. If Shrek 5 comes out, we have to review it.
we need to do a whole Shrek episode. Are you kidding?
a Shrek retrospective. On this beloved Shrek franchise that we hold so dear to our hearts. I never saw the fourth one. I'll be honest about that. You know, I saw...
I'm sure
you didn't either. Yeah, I saw 1 through 3, and then, you know, I got older, and I heard it was bad, so whatever. Anyway, no. Shrek 5, not the news I'm talking about today, Mike.
All right.
This is actually pretty insane, though. Ralph Macchio and William Zabka, best known for starring in The Karate Kid together, are developing a Karate Kid TV sequel. And it's going to be called Cobra Kai, and it's about William Zabka's character, the bully, Daniel LaRusso. I think Daniel LaRusso was the bully. It's been a while since The Karate Kid, but, you know, William Zabka was the bully. And he opens up his own karate dojo, and it's about him and his own karate dojo, and Ralph Macchio's character, I guess, has buried the hatchet with him, and they work together or something. And it sounds odd, you know, and it's going to be for YouTube Red, so no one will ever see it, and it's...
Nope.
But what's also weird about this is it's a half-hour comedy show. Instead of, like, you know, The Karate Kid, like, has its comedic moments, but I wouldn't classify it as a comedy, would you?
I mean, I guess, but not really, no.
Yeah, it's a sports movie, you know, it's a underdog sports movie. Like, it's a really fun movie. It's just very weird that this exists, and I just wanted to bring it to people's attention to the fact that it exists. I don't even have that much to say about it. I'm just perplexed by its very existence.
I really wish it was called Cobra High, and it was just like a Riverdale-style dark, gritty high school teen drama.
I would be into that, actually. You know, I actually just finished season 1 of Riverdale today.
Wow. I'm impressed.
That's perfect timing. Yeah, because I was watching it when it was airing on TV, and then I was watching so many shows at once that I had to drop a few things. I dropped all the CW shows because I knew they would be on Netflix like within a week of finishing their season. So I finally caught up on Riverdale, and it was awesome. It was...
You had to take a break. You couldn't handle the drama. That's what it was.
I mean, it's an insane show, Mike. I don't know if you are prepared for an Archie show with incest and murder, but...
Well, Just no, I didn't know I needed it. Just like you didn't know you needed a Creed 2.
With Ivan
Drago. I didn't know I needed Riverdale.
Yes. Idea, bring Ivan Drago onto Riverdale. I think could be good.
Yeah.
I think
they'll love it. Pitch it to YouTube Red.
Could be great. Could be great. So wanted to bring up this odd Cobra Kai thing. It's just perplexing. I don't have anything else to add about that. I just want to make sure that people knew it was happening so that when it does actually appear, if YouTube Red is still in business by the time it – I mean, I'm sure YouTube Red will still exist.
Yeah.
You know, whatever. Anyway, other news, and this is more WTF kind of news. DC is spiraling out of control.
Yeah, plot twist. They don't know what they're doing.
Yeah, I mean, okay, so, you know, we thought DC was getting themselves on a pretty good path, right? After Wonder Woman, right? Like, we saw Wonder Woman, we were like, hey, this was pretty good. You know, they got, you know, Joss Whedon doing reshoots on Justice League, like maybe, and James Wan's doing Aquaman. Like, maybe things are starting to turn around for old DC. And then the past couple of days have just been mind-boggling watching these DC news come out. Within 24 hours of each other, DC has announced two different movies based on the Joker, which, A, I don't think I even want to watch one movie based on the Joker.
I don't want the Joker in any movies.
Yeah, so the first one that they announced was a Joker origin story set in the 1980s, and it would have been directed by Todd Phillips, who was the director of the Hangover movies, Old School. he's a comedic director mostly, and produced by Martin Scorsese of all people, which is also its own brand of insane.
It was going to be about the Joker locking his friend the Riddler on a roof and forgetting about it.
Yes, you're still stuck on the Todd Phillips joke. I thought you were going for a Martin Scorsese joke when you.
Nope.
But there it is.
You cut me off before I got there.
It was just going to be The Hangover with the Joker, which actually Zach Galifianakis played the Joker in the Lego Batman movie. So maybe Zach Galifianakis could play the Joker in this movie, because apparently it won't star Jared Leto in this Joker Origins movie. So, like, what? if you want to recast Jared Leto, I'm totally fine with that. I don't think he's a good Joker. Totally fine. That makes complete sense. I totally understand why you wouldn't want Jared Leto in your solo Joker movie. And then the next day, they announced another movie that was also a Joker movie. And this one would be a Joker and Harley Quinn movie from the directors of Crazy Stupid Love that would star Jared Leto and Margot Robbie.
So there's that.
Like, what the fuck is happening in DC, man?
Are they trying to make a romantic comedy about Harley Quinn the Joker?
After seeing Suicide Squad, I wouldn't be surprised if they tried to do that.
Probably.
But, yeah, and also, this is in addition to Suicide Squad 2, by the way, which they still want to develop. And presumably that movie would also place a pretty big emphasis on the Joker and Harley Quinn. And also, Gotham City Sirens is kind of still in the works, which is the female-fronted villain, Suicide Squad-esque group of female villains. One of them is Harley Quinn. And I got, like, DC has basically announced, like, five different movies for these characters, and I don't think we'll ever see any of them. Like, I genuinely don't.
They have no idea what they're doing. They pick the character that no one wants a movie of, and everyone was mad at how it existed.
Yeah.
Let's make two of them.
Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, one of the things about the Joker is that you don't know his origin. Or, I mean, there is, like, an origin, like, he fell into a vat of acid and stuff like that, but he's most interesting when you don't, like, in The Dark Knight. There's that whole thing in The Dark Knight where Heath Ledger's Joker tells people how he got his scars, and the first time he does it, it's like, oh, that's how the Joker got his scars. And then the second time he does it, it's a different story, and it's like, holy shit. And so you have no idea how this thing came to be. But even then, like, the Joker doesn't really exist without Batman. It's the same, it's, you know, it's just like, why make a Joker movie if you're not going to have Batman in it?
Right.
You know? And it's kind of the same thing with, I think they saw what Sony was doing with Venom, and they were like, hey, they're doing Venom without Spider-Man. We can do Joker without Batman. Let's do it. And, you know, it's bizarre. Apparently what DC wants to do is to create another line of movies that would be separate from the DC Extended Universe and could potentially have different actors playing the same characters, which is why you would have two different Joker movies, one with Jared Leto and one with somebody else. And word on the street is that might be the case with Matt Reeves as the Batman. Matt Reeves was talking the other day about how his movie will be standalone, and people took that to mean that it's not going to be in the universe, because he'd said that, like, right after the Joker news broke out.
Right.
And then he kind of walked back in the comments and said, like, no, it will take place in the universe, but it just won't have, like, you know, cameos or references to other Justice League-esque stuff. And that's, like, fine. Like, that makes sense. Like, sure. But Word on the Street, like, there's been prevailing rumors for a long time that Ben Affleck might not be in this movie.
Which is crazy.
Yeah.
But also, sure, I guess, at this point.
I wouldn't be surprised. Like, he was supposed to direct it, and he wrote it, and the script was thrown out, and he's not directing it anymore. And it's very much seemed like he wants out of this role as soon as he can. My guess is that they're going to use the Flash movie, because they're calling that Flashpoint now. My guess is they're going to use Flashpoint to do, like, a soft reboot of their entire universe, and in the process of that, recast characters.
If there's anything the Flash as a character respects the most, Mike, it's timelines. So.
That's absolutely true. As somebody mm-hmm. who watches the TV show The Flash, I can 100% confirm that.
Support that statement.
Yes, it's super weird. Like, I can't count the amount of DC movies that have been announced over the past year or so. And I really can't imagine this bodes well for Justice League, because if you think about it, if that movie was going to be good, why would DC be promoting new movies as being separate from their universe?
Yeah, and doing the Flashpoint story.
Yeah.
That completely reboots the universe.
Yeah, it definitely seems like Justice League is going to be, like, you know, almost like damage control as much as possible. But they're kind of, like, just kind of hedging their bets until they get to the point where they can just kind of soft reboot everything or recast or whatever. And I just really don't know what's happening at DC. It's crazy. Like, when Marvel seems like such a well-oiled machine, and then to see DC do things, it's like watching the Obama administration versus the Trump administration.
Oh, man. Fucking boom goes the dynamite.
You know, you see, like, but it's been fascinating to watch the news over the past, like, year or so of the Trump administration, because there's so much insanity happening within that organization. And, like,
but Mike, you want to know the best part?
What?
It's only been 6 months.
I know. I did say a year, didn't I?
You did, yeah. Or 8 months, I guess. Yeah,
I've aged that time in the six mm-hmm. months. But what I mean, like, you know, it's like, I feel like I'm glued to Twitter all the time, because I'm just, like, reading about the, you know, the different, like, the fucking infighting and the insanity that's going on within the White House right now. And I feel like I have the same feeling reading about DC movies.
Yeah, the exact same situation. You're correct.
Exactly. It's insane. So that is DC's current situation. I have no idea what's going on there. We know at least that Justice League is coming out this year in November.
Right.
And then Aquaman comes out next year. And then from there, I don't know what's going to happen. you can bet on Wonder Woman 2. I think they announced that.
Yeah.
And I think Patty Jenkins is close to a deal to return for that. So that's good at least. But yeah, I don't know, man. I want to wash my hands of the entire DC universe, but I'm just fascinated by what's going on behind the scenes. I really hope one day there is, like, just this lengthy tell-all book about...
We're going to get a Ken Burns documentary about about what went on.
Oh, man. I would love it. I would love it so much. So wanted to bring that up. And then finally, I have one last bit of film news. This is sad. I feel like every episode, it seems like we end on somebody dying. But Jerry Lewis... Yeah. R.I.P. Jerry Lewis. You know, I will admit to not having seen most of his stuff. It's kind of a huge cinematic blind spot for me.
Yeah.
And I think you said the same thing, right? Like, you just haven't seen a lot of his stuff. And that's something I've been meaning to get to for a long time. However, I have seen Martin Scorsese's The King of Comedy. Mike, have you seen that?
I don't think I have, actually.
I think it's one of Scorsese's best, and it's really good. It's about Robert De Niro plays an aspiring comedian who kidnaps a talk show host who hosts, like, something like The Tonight Show. And that host is played by Jerry Lewis. Wow. And Jerry Lewis is kind of lampooning his own image. And he's really great in the movie. And so I wanted to just throw that out there. King of Comedy is a fantastic movie. So I wanted to throw that. And then someone pointed out to me a little, like, when it happened on Twitter, or somebody tweeted out a line from Four Rooms, which Four Rooms is a movie from 1995 that starred Tim Roth as a bellboy. That was getting into different adventures in the hotel. And basically, everything in the hotel, it's made up of, like, four different shorts. And every short is done by a different director. And the only reason that movie is significant, because it's not a very good movie, the only reason that movie is significant is because two of the shorts were directed by Robert Rodriguez and Quentin Tarantino. And it was 95, so this was, like, the year after Pulp Fiction came out. So he was, like,
right.
The hottest thing. And Tarantino's short is great. It's really good. It's very Tarantino-esque. I highly recommend you just check that out on YouTube if you can. But in that short, he actually has a monologue about Jerry Lewis and about what's going to happen when Jerry Lewis dies. And it's really fascinating. So what he says is this. He says, "As I was saying, Ted, when Norman thinks of bellboys, he thinks of Quadrophenia. But me, when I think of bellboys, I think of The Bellboy with Jerry Lewis. Did you ever see The Bellboy? You should. It's one of Jerry's better movies. He never says a word through the entire film. A completely silent performance. How many actors can pull that off? And he has to go to France to get respect. That says it all about America right there. The minute Jerry Lewis dies, every paper in this fucking country gonna write articles calling the man a genius. It's not right, and it's not fair, but why should that surprise anybody? When's America ever been fair? We might be right every once in a while, but we're very rarely fair." And that was like, whoa. Tarantino called it 20 years ago. Which is kind of insane. Did you like my Tarantino impression, by the way? I thought that was like...
I did. It was pretty good, actually. Yeah.
So, RIP Jerry Lewis. I do plan on digging into some of his filmography in the near future. But anyway, Mike, we should get into our discussions right now.
Let's do it.
All right, here we go. Watch this. These are my discussions. Just when I thought I said all I could say, my buddy and I talk about movies we see. These are my discussions. There is so much to see, you and me. So we're going to talk about movies for our discussions. All right, it's time to get into our discussions here on Film Bookcast. Mike, what do you have to discuss with us today?
Today, I have another movie from my list of cheesy fantasy movies. Fantasy sci-fi, whatever you want to call it.
Right, your 80s palooza.
Yeah, this week I have 1983's Fire and Ice.
Okay.
This is an animated movie directed by Ralph Bakshi, which I guess most well-known, just commonly, pop culturally, for directing Fritz the Cat, I guess.
He did do that. I always knew him for directing the animated Lord of the Rings movies from the 70s and 80s.
Maybe more for our listeners, Lord of the Rings, but I don't know. Fritz the Cat, I just know, is known as one of the first animated movies for adults, I guess.
Right.
And Bakshi made a career out of directing these silly, crazy, kind of creepy animated films. And this one is just kind of rote fantasy. It came out in 1983. It was actually written by Jerry Conway and Roy Thomas, that were writers of the Conan comics for Marvel at the time.
Jerry Conway is actually a writer I really like. He wrote The Night Gwen Stacy Died, one of the most iconic Spider-Man comics of all time.
Yeah, so it definitely has that kind of, like, comic book feel. There's not much dialogue, and there's a lot of just, like, fighting and action and movement, which for an animated film is really a sight to behold, especially this film. It's done with rotoscope animation, which, for anyone that doesn't know, they film the scenes in live action, and then the animators go in and kind of trace or animate over that. So a lot of the fighting, like, you know, it's battles, it's fantasy, sword battles, axes and clubs and stuff. And the movement and animation is beautiful. And a lot of it is clearly animated on top of paintings, because we see brush strokes and just large murals of a forest and all of this gorgeous rotoscope animation on top of it. So the story leaves a lot to be desired. It is a 1983 kind of rote fantasy story of, you know, the warring factions of the Fire Nation and the Ice Nation, that kind of thing.
You're describing Avatar the Last Airbender, but yeah.
Yeah. Like, literally, it's about the Ice Queen moving her glaciers south towards the Volcano King, and that's it. And it's fun. You know, it clocks in at just about, like, 82 minutes or something like that, so it's not a big investment, which is nice. So it's fun. It's cool. There is, you know, it has all of the pitfalls of early 80s fantasy in terms of the princess needs rescuing all the time and all that kind of.
Right.
For some reason, everyone is dressed in loincloths, even though we're in a giant battle and stuff, which is fine. Whatever. So, yeah, that's Fire and Ice. It was okay.
All right. Yeah, I've never seen it. I'm kind of interested in it. I remember a few years ago, I'm pretty sure Robert Rodriguez was trying to get off the ground a live action remake.
Yes, I did see that on Wikipedia, getting my information of who wrote it, and stuff. I think it was 2014 he had the rights to it. So who knows what that status is?
Right. Yeah, but I mean, I like you know, Rodriguez hasn't made a movie I've liked since Planet Terror, but
yeah.
But even then, like, I'd be kind of interested to see his interpretation of that, because I feel like he could bring something kind of cool to that story. But again, I haven't seen the original, so I don't know for sure. Have you ever seen, the way you describe it, it sounds very similar to another animated movie from the 80s called Heavy Metal. Have you ever seen that?
I have not. It's okay. Less weird from what I understand of Heavy Metal, okay. But that kind of thing, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I've seen Heavy Metal. That movie is insane. I wouldn't really call it good, but like it's insane.
This is less acid trippy from what I have heard of Heavy Metal.
Right. All right, cool. So that is Fire and Ice from 1983, and I got a few things to discuss today, Mike. First, obviously, I got to talk about Twin Peaks.
Clearly.
Which we'll wrap up soon. There's only two more weeks of Twin Peaks episodes. Three episodes left, but the last two are going to be airing back to back on the same night. Twin Peaks has now aired up through episode 15, and I'm pretty confident when I say this might be the best TV show I've ever seen.
Wow. You know, I would have never guessed from your last 10 reviews.
Yeah, I mean, have you caught up at all on the new Twin Peaks? I remember, like, last time we talked, you were on, like, episode 8 or 9.
I was on 8, I believe. I am on 10 now.
Okay, yeah, I really need you to get a little further along.
I'm going to go ahead and have to ask you to come in on Saturday and watch Twin Peaks.
Yeah, if you can come into your office and just watch Twin Peaks on Saturday, that would be...
All right, fine.
That would be ideal. Anyway, yeah, every week, I think the show has just gotten better and better. And particularly over the last couple of weeks, there's been a lot more focus on the classic Twin Peaks characters than the old show, which has been kind of a complaint that some people have had with the season. It's not a complaint that I've had, because I think the season has been so fascinating to watch. But, you know, a lot of people have been like, well, where's James? Or, like, where's Audrey? And, like, that stuff is, you know, there's still a lot of mystery surrounding a lot of those characters, but... they're there, you know, and you see a lot more of them over the last couple episodes. Episode 15 made me cry twice, Mike.
Wow.
I was so overcome with emotion. The first time from sheer joy and the other from just, like, crushing sadness. There was an incredible farewell to a cast member who died before the season aired. That is just mesmerizing. And I was wondering, actually, if they were able to pull off a David Bowie cameo before he died. That was, like, a big thing in the back of my mind. Like, I wonder, like you gotta,
yeah.
I knew they couldn't have, I knew there just wasn't going to be any way. But still, I was like, what if they did? Cause like, you know, the Log Lady, was there and like Miguel Ferrer was there and I'm like, maybe it could happen. And
it's possible.
And they even like stitched together like sort of cameos from people who have been dead for years. Like, like Bob, the guy who played Bob. They'll like reinterpret his face into a certain thing, or like the guy who played Major Briggs, Donis Davis. Like they'll have him, and they'll kind of like rework his dialogue from the old series to kind of fit in with the new one. It's really insane how they're doing it. And I was wondering if they were able to pull off a David Bowie appearance before he died. And it's evident that's not going to be happening. Even though a lot of the season revolves around his character from Firewalk with Me.
Really?
Well, yeah, he plays Philip Jeffries in that movie.
Right.
And Philip Jeffries is the guy that, you know, they keep referring to throughout the season. And so at some point I was like, they have to have some kind of appearance. Like, they keep mentioning him.
Right.
And the solution to not having Bowie is the most David Lynch thing of all time.
So excited.
And it's great. So don't even worry about that. It's pretty awesome. That is Twin Peaks. There's three episodes left. I can't wait. I think since there's not going to be any like major new movie releases over the next couple of weeks, I think our next film book cast will just be Twin Peaks. If you're
you've been pushing for so long.
If you're up for it, Mike. We'll also talk about Game of Thrones that episode, I'm pretty sure.
Right.
Because
they end the same time, right? Well,
Game of Thrones ends this Sunday.
Right.
And then Twin Peaks ends the following Sunday. So we'll talk Game of Thrones in our discussions, and then Twin Peaks can be our major review. But Game of Thrones has been very good this season, so
it has.
I've been really into it, so I'm eager to talk about that too. But we'll save it because there's one episode left. What's the point of talking about it now? We'll wait until it's finished, you know. I have a few other things I wanted to talk about. Fargo season 3. This aired back in like April and May, and I was DVRing it with the intention to watch it like, you know, the week of airing, like as I had done with Fargo season 2. And
right.
You know, I was pretty excited about it, but I was watching so much. Like, I mentioned this before, I dropped Riverdale because I was watching so much TV at that time. And like right around the same time that Fargo season 3 premiered, like Better Call Saul premiered, and like The Leftovers premiered, and Veep and Silicon Valley were on, and so much stuff was on TV at once, and I just had to draw. I wasn't able to watch Fargo, so it just kind of built up in my DVR the entire season. So I finally caught up, and it is a really good season, filled with some of my favorite working actors, like Mary Elizabeth Winstead, Carrie Coon, Shea Whigham, Michael Stuhlbarg, David Thewlis, Ray Wise is in the season.
Yeah.
And Ewan McGregor is doing great work in this show too, as a, in a double role. He's playing brothers, and he's great. It does feel like a bit of a come down from the previous two seasons, and it's a lot more of a straightforward crime narrative, I think, than season two. Season two in particular had a lot of like really experimental elements to it that I feel like season three doesn't have as much. But it doesn't negate the fact that it is still really good at what it does. Like, if the dark comedy is there and the humor is there, and you know, the actual like dramatic tension is there, and also they went really heavy on Big Lebowski references this year, like
really
like a lot. Like, you know, the show has always referenced Coen Brothers movies throughout, mm-hmm. and season one was obviously a riff on the original Fargo, and you know, it also had kind of elements of The Man Who Wasn't There, and that they cast Billy Bob Thornton, and there's certain things in the background. And then season two, I remember specifically there was a scene that aped Raising Arizona towards the end of season two, where they have like the Nick Cage dream sequence. But they also had, like, season two also would lift songs from Coen Brothers movies and play them in the background of scenes. And that was always really, that was really cool and geeky too for me.
Yep.
And then this year, I feel like, you know, there were references to other stuff, but for the most part, there was a lot of Lebowski references. Like, there's a lot, to the point where like, was it, it felt like it was its main influence. But there's literally a scene where Mary Elizabeth Winstead shows up at a bowling alley and sits down at a bar, and then the camera like pans across the bar, and a guy, Ray Wise, is there in the, basically as the Sam Elliott character, and they have like basically the same conversation, or a conversation that fits the same purpose as the scene from with the dude in the Stranger in Lebowski. It is crazy. And even then, there's just like lines of dialogue, like somebody will say something and somebody, and the person will respond, "That's not the preferred nomenclature." And it's like, what is happening?
That's amazing.
So yeah, I mean, I really enjoyed Fargo season three. I don't think it's quite as good as season one and two, but it is a really great crime tale. It's a really fun show. And also literally the actors that I just listed are among my favorite actors working today. Like, it's just a really incredible cast all around. So definitely worth checking out, especially if you love the first two seasons. Especially, actually, a character from season one shows up around episode 7, and it's the best. Like, the reveal of that character is amazing. So it's definitely worth checking out. So I know you are a big fan of Fargo, and you just haven't watched this new season, right?
Yeah, I think I watched the first two episodes or so, and it didn't hook me like the other seasons did. So I kind of, it's on the DVR, same situation. I have them, I just haven't gotten around to them yet. Yeah. So
once you finish up with Twin Peaks, then you know, Fargo should be your next thing, I think.
All right.
But yeah, and then I have two movies I wanted to talk about before we get into our review. The first is Detroit, which is the new film from Kathryn Bigelow, and I think it is the best of her recent. I don't really know what to call them, narrative journalism movies. you know,
yeah, sure.
I've never been like the hugest fan of The Hurt Locker. That's a movie that didn't really work for me outside of a couple of scenes that are really great. I did like Zero Dark Thirty. I thought Zero Dark Thirty was pretty good, but I think this is the best of them. It's a dramatization of an incident at a hotel during the Detroit riots in 1967. And it's just an intense and harrowing experience. It's incredibly tough to watch, but I found it very valuable. And I think it's a very interesting look at society. And like, obviously it feels very important in today's climate that sense. So wanted to mention Detroit. And then the other movie I wanted to talk about was Atomic Blonde, which is the new movie from John Wick co-director David Leitch. And it has a very similar action aesthetic to John Wick. This place is Charlize Theron as a spy during the Cold War in the late 80s. And it's a fun time. It's just all around a really enjoyable time. The story is incredibly difficult to follow. But the action is incredible. And here's the thing. It's not as much of an action movie as the John Wicks are. And I feel like I was kind of unprepared for it to not be as action oriented. Like, I was expecting, you know, half hour fight scenes like in the
right.
John Wick.
Yeah.
And this is much more of like a spy thriller, like an espionage kind of thriller. And it works in that regard. There's solid stuff happening throughout, but the action is really incredible. There is one stairway fight. It's about 10 minutes long, all done in one take. And wow. It's a stairway fight that turns into a car chase. And it, like, starts off in a building, and, like, you see her go through the entire building, and it goes out into a street, and, like, they get in the car. And it's a really long shot. It's mind-boggling, and, like, there are, you know, obvious hidden cuts throughout, but it really flows well, and it really works. And it's great, because, I mean, at that point in the movie, like, it probably happens, like, an hour in. And for that first hour, I was like, I'm not sure if I'm, like, as into this as I want to be. And then that scene kicks in, and I'm like, okay. And I was on board for the rest of the movie after that, so... Nice. Definitely worth checking out. Have you seen either of those? I know you wanted to see Atomic Blonde.
Yeah, no, I wanted to see both of those. I just haven't gotten around to them. Nope. But there, I guess I will.
Yeah, cool beans. All right, and that's Atomic Blonde, and we should move on, Mike. Let's get into our featured review of Logan Lucky.
Jimmy, I'm just going to say it. I got to let you go.
You were just fired.
I was let go for liability reasons involving insurance.
The one-armed bartender.
You need to show a little respect.
Charlotte Motor Speedway. I know how they move the money.
The only guy who knows anything about blowing up real bank vaults is Joe Bang.
I am incarcerated.
Yeah, we got a plan to get you out.
All right, that was from the trailer for Logan Lucky, the new movie directed by Steven Soderbergh and written by Rebecca Blunt. There has been some different sides about if Rebecca Blunt actually exists. I don't know if you know that, Mike.
I didn't hear that.
Well, Steven Soderbergh is known, like, he shoots and edits all his movies himself, but he does it under pseudonyms, Gregory Jacobs and Mary Ann Bernard. And so people think that Steven Soderbergh himself might have written this movie, and just did it under the name Rebecca Blunt, because he is the only one that seems to he's telling people that she exists, but, like, no one else seems to be able to corroborate that story.
They've never been in the scene in the same room together,
yeah,
kind of thing.
So it's kind of interesting. I do want to dig more into that at some point. But yeah, anyway,
that's amazing.
So directed by Steven Soderbergh, supposedly written by Rebecca Blunt, and stars Channing Tatum, Adam Driver, Riley Keough, Seth MacFarlane, Katie Holmes, Catherine Waterston, Dwight Yoakam, Sebastian Stan, Hilary Swank, Brian Gleeson, Jack Quaid, and introducing Daniel Craig as Joe Bang.
Amazing.
Among some others as well. It is a pretty phenomenal cast they assemble for this movie.
Stacked.
It is
yeah.
Insane. And the IMDb plot synopsis for Logan Lucky reads, two brothers attempt to pull off a heist during a NASCAR race in North Carolina. And that is all that IMDb says, and that's all you really need to know, I guess. You know,
yeah.
It's exactly.
Pretty much.
The movie delivers exactly what that plot synopsis says. You don't even have to see the movie. You can just read the synopsis and be like, I got it. So Steven Soderbergh, one of my favorite working directors, although I'll admit to not having seen maybe like half of his filmography, because he just makes so much stuff. It's a back catalog that I've been slowly working through. But I was supremely bummed out when he announced that he was retiring a few years back. 2013, Soderbergh released Side Effects and Behind the Candelabra, and that was theoretically the end of his filmmaking career while he pursued other projects. Now, I never for a second believed he'd be gone forever.
Right.
I did not expect he'd be back within 4 years. You know, there are directors who don't retire who just go that amount of time without making a movie anyway.
Yeah. Yeah.
Know? Like, James Cameron's last movie was in 2009, you know, and it's,
right.
He's been, you know, fiddling around on Pandora for a decade now. But, yeah. In any case, Soderbergh retired and pursued other projects, and he really pursued some other projects, because in the 4 years he was gone, he directed every episode of The Nick on Cinemax. He produced a TV show based on his movie The Girlfriend Experience for Starz. He started a t-shirt line. He started a liquor distribution label. He released his own edits of classic films like Psycho and 2001 A Space Odyssey online.
I heard about it. Yeah.
And he wrote a novella and published it over a long series of tweets.
Which is the best thing of all time.
Yeah, it is insane. I remember when he was doing that, because if you follow him on Twitter, he tweets under the handle Bituation, which is even better. But yeah, I remember when he was doing that. Like, he started a Twitter probably like right before he retired or around that time. And I remember just being on Twitter randomly, and I would just like see him tweet and just be like a big all caps letters like Chapter 3, and then my entire Twitter timeline would be just his tweets for, you know, an hour. And
Yeah.
Like, and every day it would just be random. Like, suddenly you just see chapter six and it's like, oh my God, there's another. it's pretty bonkers. So yeah, he is somebody who is just constantly working.
And, yeah,
you know, I would say, like, not everything he has made is great, but it is always really interesting, whatever he's doing. So now he returns with Logan Lucky, and it's kind of hard not to compare it to Soderbergh's most successful film, Ocean's 11,
right?
And its two sequels, 12 and 13. You know, Soderbergh essentially redefined the heist movie for a new century with Ocean's 11. So to see him return to that genre is really exciting. So, Mike, what are your overall thoughts on Logan Lucky?
Logan Lucky, it's interesting to think about. You know, like I said earlier, my kind of exposure when I became aware of Steven Soderbergh was Contagion, Haywire, and Side Effects.
Nice. So you got in and, just as he was leaving the scene.
yeah. I mean, or it's one of those things where, you know, I became aware of his name kind of thing. And, you know, obviously I had seen the Ocean's movies and all that stuff. But those three movies, particularly the ones right at the ends, Contagion, Haywire, and Side Effects, are all very similar stylistically. They are really quick paced. They're really odd lighting choices, and they're, you know, they kind of fit like a trilogy in some way, at least in terms of his style and everything.
Yeah, pretty much every movie he's made since the 2010s. He's talking about his lighting choices. Pretty much every movie he's made since the 2010s has this like yellow filter.
Yeah. There's this weird fluorescent thing going on.
Yeah.
So I was kind of expecting that going into Logan Lucky. As I think we mentioned at the end of our last film book cast, I went in pretty much completely cold to Logan Lucky.
Right.
I hadn't seen much of the trailer. I hadn't seen a whole trailer, at least.
Right. You hadn't even seen Daniel Craig as Joe Bang.
Yeah, I had seen him. I hadn't heard him. Okay. I didn't know what was going on. So when he starts talking, that blew my mind. But so I didn't know what to expect and going in. And then we get this kind of like down home hillbilly heist movie. And it was hilarious. I wasn't ready for any of that.
Right.
Because those other three movies are tense, you know, heart pounding thrillers.
Thrillers, yeah.
Yeah. And we just get this like kind of silly dark comedy. I say dark comedy, but it's not particularly dark. It's kind of just awkward comedy.
Yeah.
There's or goofball, I guess,
goofball. One of would be the best way to describe it.
Yeah. A goofball comedy. And I really enjoyed it. It's not great by any means, but it's still a lot of fun. There are moments, particularly one moment that I'm sure this movie will be remembered for, that had me doubled over laughing. And I think I saw your reaction was that as well.
Yeah.
yes.
Spoilers, but yeah.
Yes. Yeah. And you know, the dialogue is really fast and funny for a lot of it. For some, in particular, certain characters have that kind of those moments.
Right.
And all the performances are great. As you said earlier, this cast is large and robust.
Yeah,
there's right. Lots of people that I wasn't expecting to show up for the 4 minutes that they're in this movie, but they're there.
Super well-known actors will pop in for a scene and then leave. Like,
It's amazing. My man Macon Blair shows up. For a while.
Yeah, he does.
He's my boy. Yeah, so that was cool to see him in there. I had a lot of fun with this movie.
Yeah, I had a goddamn blast with Logan Lucky. And you mentioned, you know, those three movies, that Contagion and Haywire and Side Effects, and those were all thrillers. But Soderbergh has always had a really playful side to him as well. You know, the Ocean's movies are essentially comedies.
Right, absolutely.
And I think that's how he sees them. And, you know, so there's that. And, you know, he made Magic Mike, you know? He's a really versatile director in that respect.
Yeah.
He also, I forgot to mention, during his retirement, he also shot and edited Magic Mike XXL. So he didn't direct that movie.
He just does it all.
Yeah, he wasn't the director of that movie, but he was on set and, you know, shot the movie and edited it. It's insane. And actually,
directed by Rachel Blunt.
Yeah.
Or Rebecca Blunt, or whatever her name was.
I forget the name of the director who did Magic Mike XXL, but it's somebody who's worked with Soderbergh a lot in the past. So it's like it was essentially directed by Soderbergh, like in the sense that he was there on set, but like it was actually this other guy. So I think it's a Spielberg, Toby Hooper, Poltergeist situation kind of thing.
Right.
Speaking of Magic Mike XXL, though, like I've seen both of those Magic Mike movies. XXL is amazing. it's really good.
Isn't that one of Film Crit Hulk's like crusades to everyone to recognize the majesty that
there,
is?
There's like a select group of film critics who really love Magic Mike XXL,
yeah.
And I don't love it as much as they do, but it's a really good movie. I wasn't the biggest fan of the first one, but the second one is really fun. So the first one's more of a drama than it is like a the second one is like a road trip comedy. With like a bunch of bros just stripping, and it's pretty great. And like,
fair enough. You're like, on the wrong Soderbergh movie, Mike.
Yes, that's true. But just throwing this out there, Magic Mike XXL. If you feel uncomfortable watching it, don't be. It's really great.
All right.
But anyway, yeah, I had a goddamn blast with Logan Lucky. You know, Soderbergh is back in action, taking these familiar heist tropes but placing them in this like unique setting. It's just so much fun to watch. Like this, and also this is kind of like a very leisurely kind of heist movie. You know, I feel
You
know, with the Ocean's movies, like those are so like crisp and sharp and like quickly paced. And this movie like really takes its time, I think, and just kind of just lets you hang out with these characters. And as a result, this feels like a more like lived in environment. Even when you have like over the top or like cartoonish things happening, which happened quite a bit in this movie, like Seth MacFarlane, for example, who feels like he walked in off the set of a different movie.
Yep, straight up.
If there's one miscast actor in this movie, I do feel like it's Seth MacFarlane. I think he was fine. Like I think you know he was serviceable. And I think he sort of hired Seth MacFarlane and just told him, hey, do a British accent for the hell of it, and like that's.
Yeah, we're gonna put this weird Jerry Curl wig on you.
It was an odd choice, and he's the one in the ensemble that doesn't quite gel the same way that everyone else does. But you know, I still enjoyed watching him anyway. Like it's a very small thing. But the actor getting the most press for this movie is Daniel Craig as Joe Bang, and I think rightfully so. It is downright jarring to see Daniel Craig in this role.
And
I was looking back outside of his Force Awakens cameo. He has not been in a non-James Bond movie since Girl with a Dragon Tattoo in 2011.
Wow.
And there's only been two James Bond movies since then, Skyfall and Spectre.
Yeah.
So he's only been in two movies.
He's got that Bond money now.
He's got that Bond money, I guess. And he hates it. He hates it so much.
He'd rather slash his wrists, Mike.
But he's coming back, man. He is coming back to the role. One last ride. But we've never seen Daniel Craig like this before, I feel like. He's never played this kind of character before, and he's just out and out having a blast as this character. He's just playing this wild force of nature, and I really hope he does more stuff like this once he's done with Bond. I saw you give me the finger guns, which I assume means because I made the fact that he said I said blast. That was unintentional.
Yep, that was it.
But I appreciate the finger guns nonetheless. And
sometimes they do things just for you, Mike.
And the rest of this cast is pretty perfect too, give or take a McFarlane. You know, I wish Riley Keough, the sister, had gotten more to do. She's a really great actress. She was one of the wives in Mad Max Fury Road. She was in American Honey, which is a great movie, and she's actually the star of the Girlfriend Experience on Stars, the show that sort of produces. So there's that. But Channing Tatum and Adam Driver are great together. Like they really feel like brothers to me. In this movie, and honestly, the highlight of the movie for me might have been Joe Bang's brothers, played by Brian Gleason and Jack Quaid, who are just hilarious together. I didn't really know either of those actors, and now I'm really invested in their future as actors.
Yeah, I do love just how failing forward all of everything is in this movie. The brothers. Those characters are hilarious, bumbling, amazing characters in the best ways.
Yeah, they are incredible. And that's the thing. The movie is really, really funny. And I think I've laughed harder in this movie than I have at anything else I've seen in theater so far this year. Like I'm trying, there hasn't really been that many like comedies out this year, like any like big wide release comedies I can think of. And like, you know, there's stuff like Guardians Volume 2, which is really funny. Like that was a funny movie. And like Baby Driver is funny. But you know, those are more like Guardians is actually more of a superhero movie with funny moments, and I mean, no, Guardians is pretty funny throughout. But Baby Driver is more of an action movie with you know comedic moments throughout, and this is like straight up, it's a comedy. And you know, there are lulls in the comedy where like there's emotional moments and stuff like that, but really, like there are incredible comedic sequences in this movie that are just so good. And just everything in this movie just feels like a master director shaking off the cobwebs and just being like, oh, here's how you make a movie. And like at its best, I think this movie felt like a cross between Ocean's 11 and Raising Arizona to me. And that's a combo I need to see a lot more of in the near future.
That is a very apt description. It is interesting, like you said too, to see him Soderbergh come back to the heist movie as his kind of return to filmmaking. And I say that in loose air quotes, right, since he never really stopped, like we talked about. But to see him come back to something so familiar in such a unique way as his return is really cool and interesting to see.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I will say, after the actual heist is over, there's still a decent amount of movie left. And
yeah,
I thought it still really worked, but I did sort of come down a little bit from the high of the actual heist happenings. Once the FBI investigation kicks in, I'm like, yeah, this is still really good. But it just kind of felt like an extended epilogue to me, as opposed to the story that we were invested in for most of the movie.
Definitely drags on a bit in that section,
just a little bit. But I think it ends really well. As well, so it kind of comes back around, and it's still really good in that stuff too. Like, I'm not complaining that it's there, you know.
Yeah,
it just feels like it's not the same movie as it was like the first hour and a half or so. Mm-hmm. But that's like a very small complaint. Again, every complaint I have with this movie is just very small, because the amount of sheer joy I felt while watching it is just unparalleled, and I'm a big fan of that. Like, I'm just glad Soderbergh is back, man. And you know, he's coming back with a vengeance. Like, Logan Lucky did not light the box office on fire, which is a shame. But in the meantime, like, he also shot another movie in secret while making Logan Lucky.
What?
On his iPhone.
I think I heard about that, actually. Yeah.
And I don't remember what it's about, but it stars Juno Temple. And so I'm eager to see that. That sounds like more of his. He's kind of the model of the one for them, one for me kind of director. Like, he directs so mm-hmm. much stuff. And usually what he does is he'll do like a big studio movie, and that'll give him the clout to make whatever personal project that he wants to work on. So I'm guessing this next movie will be the personal project that he wants to work on.
Yeah.
So I'm pretty excited to see what that could be. And then he's also got that show Mosaic on HBO, that weird choose your own adventure thing that we talked about a while ago.
apparently
that's really happening. Supposedly it's premiering in 2018.
Wow.
And I have no idea how that's going to work, but I'm into it. Like,
yeah, let's find out.
Yeah, like, he's just somebody who is just always trying to experiment and do new stuff, and I really appreciate that about Steven Soderbergh. And he's such a versatile director. Like, he can do pretty much anything. And so I'm just excited to see where he goes from here now that he's back doing what he does best. Do you have other thoughts about Logan Lucky, Mike, before we should move into spoilers?
No, I think we covered it pretty well. Let's talk about some spoiler stuff.
All right, let's do it. Let's get into spoilers for Logan Lucky, starting right now. All right, spoilers for Logan Lucky, starting right now. So there is the reveal at the end of the movie that after giving back all the money, Channing Tatum actually did steal a bunch of the money. It's a heist movie. I really like that twist. I feel like, because we kind of had the same reaction in Matchstick Men. Do you remember we were talking about that for Complete Works? And there's a twist at the end, you know, the crazy twist at the end of Matchstick Men that I didn't see coming at all.
Right.
And I kind of felt the same way coming out of this movie. And I felt really stupid about it, because I felt like I should have expected there to be some kind of twist, because it's a heist movie or a comedy movie. But I guess I'm just like an easy mark for that kind of stuff. I don't know.
I guess so. Yeah.
But, you know, I really liked the twist at the end that they did actually steal a bunch of the money. And the fact that he did ultimately give everyone their equal share is just really nice. Like, it's really endearing.
Yeah, there's a really good head fake there where he has that, like, moment of redemption, it seems, and the change of heart, right, where he becomes the father his daughter wants him to be, kind of thing.
Right.
But, like, wink, wink, he's still a good thief, I guess. I don't know, I totally fell for it, too, that I thought that was it. He gave the money back, change of heart. But nope, they were all in on it.
Yeah, and it's just like Ocean's 11. There's always another layer to the plan that's not revealed to you until the very end of the movie,
right?
Which is always like, that was always a great thing in Ocean's 11, and it works really well here. So pretty psyched about that. And I just love that he gave everyone their equal share. Like, you know, you see Daniel Craig dig up his thing as in the under the tree, and then you see like a montage of people getting money from Channing Tatum, and you see like the woman who was kicked out of a safe because of the cake, who was just used as a pawn in their scheme. Like, she had no involvement in what they were doing.
Right.
And he gives her money, and like, he gives money to Catherine Watterson, the doctor who was nice to him. And like, it's just nice.
He's just a good guy.
Everything just feels really earnest and heartfelt throughout this movie. Like, usually when you're watching a heist movie, I feel like you're watching these like incredibly like smooth talking, attractive, smart people. And in this, you're just watching like a group of rednecks But the movie never feels like it's making fun of them. It's just kind of like amplifying their eccentricities for like comedic effect. And I think it really works. So I really dig that. I think Soderbergh actually grew up in like West Virginia, like that area. I think he has a lot of affection for those people and for that area that he grew up in. And so I feel like that comes through in this movie.
There's definitely a sense of, I think you said earnestness earlier, that we, like you said, we're not making fun of these people. We're just in rural West Virginia, where the big thing is the county fair and NASCAR and the mobile, the doctors, I lost it. They're like mobile clinic. There we go.
Right.
Have to come through and give out free vaccines and booster shots and stuff. You know, it's all that Southern pride kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Or small town pride. But mixed in with really accidentally capable thieves.
Yes.
or very capable thieves that are accident prone. I'll say that. Yeah. I'll say it that way.
Definitely. Before we mentioned that there's one scene in particular that we thought was just so fucking funny, I'm assuming you're talking about the Game of Thrones scene.
Of course I am.
Yeah, so there's a prison riot that's staged to break out Daniel Craig and Adam Driver from prison so they can participate in the heist. And so the prison riot is happening, and the prisoner gives a list of demands to the warden. And the warden is reading it, and he's just like, well, here's the thing. I can get you all the Song of Ice and Fire books up through A Dance with Dragons, but The Winds of Winter and whatever the other one is have not been published yet, so I cannot give you that. And the one prisoner just keeps coming up to the monitor and just so indignant about it. Like, what are you talking about? George R. R. Martin was supposed to have that into his publisher 2 years ago. And the warden is just like, yeah, I'm reading from his Wikipedia page. It says he had a very difficult publishing schedule and it just didn't work out. And he just keeps coming back up and it's like, that don't make no sense. This one guy knew what happened to the Dragon Lady. And it's like, I believe he got that info from the television series.
Right. Yeah, it took up for a really long time.
It was amazing. It's the best Game of Thrones reference of all time. And it reminded me a lot of the big Lord of the Rings reference in The Martian, actually, is what I kind of – just that's kind of like epic nerdery reference. And it's incredible. It's so, so good. So I love that. A close second to that scene, though, is the scene where Joe Bang is developing a bomb made of gummy bears and has to explain the science behind it and has
– we'll have to stop.
Goes through the whole thing, like just writes it out on the wall and stuff. And the actual process of putting it into the tube and then shooting back out of the tube and just smacking Adam Driver in the chest and his like terrified reaction. It's amazing. It's so good. And this movie is filled with scenes like that, that is just so much fun. And like every interaction between the characters is just so much good. Are there any other like standout scenes to you that you wanted to talk about, Mike?
I think for some reason the Seth MacFarlane scenes stand out to me, and I think just because of the pure eccentricity of his character.
Sure.
And I think, like you did say, he's in a different movie.
Yeah.
and it doesn't exactly detract from this movie, right? Like, it just feels like a big, bombastic, weird, like, advertising guy that's like a British rock star with a Jerry curl for some reason. But I did really enjoy the last scene of the movie in the bar when we have the like bringing the group back together thing.
Yeah.
And you know, we're going down the line, seeing everyone toasting to each other, and the reveal that Hilary Swank is there.
Yeah,
Who is an FBI agent for 5 minutes of this? Well, 15 minutes of this movie.
So that's kind of the ending period of the movie. We're watching Hilary Swank try to investigate this the heist about what happened and getting nowhere, and ultimately being taken off the case. But I think the ending is actually is kind of pessimistic and like kind of bleak in a way, because the way they talk about it, you know, they talk about the Logan curse.
Right.
Earlier in the movie, they talk about how the Logan curse always goes into effect whenever things are going really well. And so like Channing Tatum blows out his knee right when he's like the quarterback and the king of his high school, and Adam Driver loses his arm while he's coming back from Iraq, like on a helicopter ride back.
Yeah.
And so I feel like the ending implies like Hilary Swank is there and says she was taken off the case, but I feel like it's implied that she's like still working undercover.
Yeah, it seems like she's there to bust them.
Yeah. So it's implied that like the bad luck always strikes right when things are going well, and the camera like, you know, cuts to black as it pans out, and it's like, oh shit.
Yeah.
So I feel like bad times are ahead for the Logan family, which we'll thankfully never see. I don't want, like, I feel like it ends on a great happy ending for all of them, and the implication that things are going to get bad in the future, but we don't have to see that. That's the
yeah. I also did appreciate the kind of second montage that we get, or heist montage that we get towards the end. I think it happens towards the end of the film, where we kind of get the, like, and here's what really happened, yep. Which is it straight out of the Ocean's Playbook.
Very much, yeah.
But it's still so much fun just in this kind of hillbilly redneck version. the low-tech version of the Great Ocean's twist, yes. On the other heist.
Yeah.
So that was fun.
Yeah, it's pretty great. So I also wanted to mention the first time you see Joe Bang's brothers, because there's an incredible exchange with them where they're talking about their moral opposition to this job.
Yes, and I forgot about that.
They start talking, they give like this long reason about how they're morally opposed to shoplifting now, specifically from this particular store that sponsors the race. And then they, like, Channing Tatum and Adam Driver give this long story about how their sister was, like, sexually assaulted by an employee at that store. And so they're like, yeah, we got no love lost for that store either. And then, and then the two brothers turn around and they just go, what you think? And the other guy's like, immediately, yeah. And they're like, all right, we're in.
It's perfect.
It's so good. I did want to talk a little bit about the emotional through line of Channing Tatum's character. I feel like the idea of will he make it to his daughter's recital on time is such an overused plot device, you know.
Yeah.
To the point where it is specifically parodied in Anchorman 2. Like it is it was, wow. Like a big thing in that movie where, like, Ron Burgundy had to make it back to his son's recital, and then got caught up in, like, this gigantic, like, you know, did you see Anchorman 2 by any chance?
No, really? I didn't.
Okay, Anchorman 2 is a lot better than people give it credit for. But okay. He gets caught up in, like, the big, like, you know, Anchorman has that big fight between all the stations. Anchorman 2 has an even bigger one. That's, like, the climax of the movie. And so he gets out, like, he makes it back to the recital after getting out of that huge fight. And the idea of, like, making it to the daughter's recital on time is such, like, an overused plot trope, but, like, I feel like it really works here. Like, I don't know. I really liked it. Like, I think the daughter was really endearing. Like, it's a good kid actor, and those are tough to come by. But even just, and maybe I'm just a sucker for John Denver songs. Like,
that might be it.
That might be it. That might be why it worked for me. But just like I feel like there's an authenticity to the daughter's performance of that song. Like, it's not, she's not singing it well. You know, it's a really, like, off key and, like, weird, but it's a kid singing it, you know, and it feels like an actual, like, little kid is singing that song. And then you have the entire crowd kind of softly, like, getting into it. And it's nice. It's just really nice. I like that a lot.
Yeah. I did think that serves, like, so much of the sense of tension throughout the heist comes from them pulling it off, you know, will they pull it off and all this stuff. And then they do. And then we kind of have more attention of this kind of just, you know, what we've been talking about, this kind of earnest small town story of, like, dad's got to get to the recital on time after. And because it's not, you know, it's such a juxtaposition of such literal high stakes of stealing, of robbing this NASCAR track on the busiest day of the year, the biggest race, and having to make it on time to this. Yeah. Silly recital.
Yeah, it's like you're watching, like, you know, Neglectful Father in a Small Town, and it's like, what is this, 90s Spielberg?
But, yeah. God damn it.
But yeah, anyway, I really enjoyed Logan Lucky. I thought it was a blast. Michael seemed like you did, too. Do you have anything else you wanted to touch on before we wrap up for today?
Yeah, I mean, I had a lot of fun. I thought it's weird. It's weird in the best ways. And that's kind of it. Yeah.
There's so much great work done by Soderbergh in terms of his direction and in terms of the screenplay is just really sharp, and all the character interactions are just so much fun. Like, it's just a fun group of characters to be around, and I wish we could get, like, an Ocean style franchise out of Logan Lucky.
Oh, God.
I don't think it's going to happen, because it did not make a ton of money at the box office. Although it was only budgeted for, like, $30 million, so I feel like it'll make a profit in any case, but
hopefully.
Yeah, but even if it doesn't, like, it's not a huge loss, because it was budgeted pretty low, so. That's good, at least. Soderbergh can keep on working, and that's what I want. That's all I want. More Soderbergh all the time.
That's all we ask for.
Anyway, Mike, where can we find you online this week?
You can find me at twitter.com/mdfilmblog. And if you like Dungeons & Dragons, my friends and I post our games at youtube.com/geonerd79.
And you can find me online at twitter.com/msmithfilmblog and all of our podcasts and stuff at filmbook.com. And I also write for crookedscoreboard.com. You can check me out there. Thank you so much for listening to Filmbookcast. I'm Mike Smith. That is Mike DiCriscio. If you are listening to this review via our podcast on iTunes, you can subscribe to the podcast, rate it, take a moment to give us a review. Any and all feedback, compliments, topic discussions, even hate mail can be sent directly to podcast@filmbook.com. Please list the podcast you're emailing about in the title of your email, because we produce just so many different podcasts, Mike. It is hard to keep track. We would love to hear from you. Join us for the next episode of Film Bookcast in 2 weeks, where I think we're just going deep on Twin Peaks The Return.
Let's do it.
And we'll talk Game of Thrones as well. But Twin Peaks, I really want to just really dig into that and get into all the spoilery stuff that's going on. In as much as Twin Peaks is a show that can be spoiled, because again,
yeah.
I don't think it's even like you would only scratch the surface if you just said what happens on the show. You know,
right.
it's just so insane. Especially, I mean, the last couple. We'll save it, but
save it.
I really need to talk about it with somebody, and that somebody will definitely be you, because we have a podcast together. And you can check out our next complete works, where we are talking Nicolas Cage's role in 2005's The Weatherman. Can't find The Weatherman. Pretty
smash cuts of credits.
Yeah, I'm pretty excited about that. That's a Gore Verbinski movie that I haven't seen. I'm pretty sure it's the only Gore Verbinski movie I haven't seen. So eager to get in on that. So thank you so much for listening, guys. We are out. Like a breeze, country roads, take